Hello once again, dear listeners. As always, I'm Craig Eastman, and with me, as always, is Scott Morris.
Hello.
And Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
Tonight is a special treat for you. We're not using the wonders of Skype. We're actually all gathered in the one room. But as per usual, we're going to be chatting about some films which we have seen recently, or which, well, I haven't seen any of them as a matter of fact, but I know two guys who have. So without further ado, we'll crack on and hopefully entertain you for the next half hour. And if we don't entertain you, well, you didn't pay for it, so you can't have your money back. Beat it. Right, okay, first on the agenda tonight, we're going to have a chat about We Own the Night. It's a bold claim. Scott, tell us more about it.
Yep, it is a bold claim. It's emblazoned on the jackets of New York PD cops on the night streets. Well, at least it was in the 80s, although it's wishful thinking more than actual fact.
No.
Front line of the war on drugs, which I suppose has ended now. We don't hear an awful lot about it. Don't know if we won or not. It concerns a family of cops, the Grzynskis, headed by Deputy Chief Albert, who's played by Robert Duvall, and rising young star Joe, who's played by Marky Mark Wahlberg. Joe's brother Bobby, who Joaquin Phoenix, is the unwelcome black sheep who runs a successful club and takes his mother's maiden name to ensure that his occasionally drug-fueled lifestyle and friends of dubious legality don't get antsy and suspicious. This uneasy equilibrium goes to pot when Joe suspects regulars at Bobby's club of being drug traffickers in the Russian mafia and shakes down the club.
Hate it when that happens.
He hates it more because retaliation is swift, with a supposedly professional hit carried out in Joe that leaves him quadruspazed on a life plug, fighting for his life. Although you have to question how professional a hit can be if they failed to kill him at point-blank range.
Schoolboy error. Didn't you put bullets in it? Dull.
Weighing up the options between the crims who have treated him as family and his actual family, he goes with his blood and delves deeper into the operation, finding out the location of the Russian drug processing safe houses. This doesn't go quite to plan. His cover's blown halfway through a raid and he has to go into hiding under police protection. Well, that's how my brain has rewritten the script to make a modicum of sense. He's actually in witness protection until an upcoming trial, despite the fact that the criminals were caught red-handed in the middle of a cocaine processing factory and had a shootout with the cops. Somehow he still needed his testimony for some reason that never really makes a lick of sense. He goes into hiding with his girlfriend Amanda, Eva Mendes, and this doesn't go exactly to plan either, leading to more shootout-based tragedies. It's not a bad film. It's mostly enjoyable. You've got the cast on pretty reasonable form throughout. Believable family drama. They do feel like a kind of cohesive unit for most of the time. There's some reasonably tasty shootouts. You just can't really escape the feeling that it has a kind of made-for-TV kind of feel.
Mm.
It never feels particularly like it ought to be on the big screen. The plot's relatively familiar. There's nothing particularly new in it. There's moments of just plain idiotic scripting that just don't make any sense, which kind of undermine it a little bit. And it's a good example, as I can think of taking something that's really mediocre and just shining it until you end up with something that's shiny enough that you might not notice how mediocre it is on first glance, but that's basically what it is.
Now, see, for the longest part of that rant there, I was thinking, blah, 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 police, blah, blah, blah. But then you said two words, Scott. Drew, what were those two words?
Those two words must have been Eva Mendes.
Oh, that's what I'm talking about. So I don't even need to now ask you now if this is a film worth checking up on, because I'm going to have to catch up on it because Eva Mendes was in it. But for people out there who may not be as shallow as I am, Drew, is this a worthwhile film catching up on?
While Eva Mendes is extremely attractive and does look very good in this film, no. You could just watch the first 10 minutes when Eva Mendes looks at her best and then leave.
Possibly get on the internet, just download some pictures.
Yes. It would save you a lot of money and time. It's not awful, but the idea of it being polished mediocrity is quite accurate. And certainly watching it, there's nothing original about the story, and I certainly, watching it, I was thinking, enjoyed this better when it was Russell Crowe and Denzel Washington a couple of months ago.
It does feel kind of strange. It feels like almost like it's sort of cut into two films. There's one little story arc going on, then it sort of abruptly stops and starts another little story arc.
It hasn't had the greatest of press exposure, has it? Almost as if it knows it's kind of beaten before it comes out the starting blocks, really, by the likes of American Gangster and whatnot, is it? It doesn't hold up well against that.
Yeah, no. But it didn't deserve much more press, because it's underwritten, and it doesn't really serve its leads very well, because other films, Joaquin Phoenix and Robert Duvall particularly...
It certainly sounds like an impressive enough cast list.
Yeah, I mean, Robert Duvall and Joaquin Phoenix, especially Robert Duvall, just deserve much better scripting.
Mendes.
Yes, and Eva Mendes just deserves more screen time for being awesome. It's not... I wouldn't rush out and watch it. I mean, I suspect if you like Robert Duvall, Joaquin Phoenix or Mark Wahlberg, you might get something out of it similarly as being a fan of them, and you'd enjoy it, but it's not anything to get excited about, nothing to seek out particularly.
Do enough people get shot in the head?
No.
Oh.
No, never enough people get shot in the head in anything.
No, exactly. Please rectify this. So not one that we're going to get to cock-a-hoop then, by the sounds of it. Don't know if I'm going to catch up on it. I feel sort of contractually obliged to because Eva Mendes is in it, but we'll see. Another film I haven't seen this week, but with good reason this time, is Charlie Wilson's War, in which Tom Hanks plays real-life Congressman Charlie Wilson, wouldn't you believe it, who many credit with having funded the covert war which defeated the Russians in Afghanistan. Scott, say ye yay or nay?
Well, I say mostly meh, but we'll get onto that later. But as you say, Tom Hanks steps into the hard-drinking Texas Congressman Charlie Wilson's shoes as he takes an interest in the Soviet-Afghan war. Interpreting it as the sharp edge in the Cold War, he decides to use his position on appropriations committees to increase the cash allocated to covert help of the Afghans against the Red Menace. Meanwhile, CIA agent Gust Avakrotos, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, is busy smashing his boss's office window after being passed over for a promotion, and winds up assigned to the underfunded Afghan desk, where it's immediately apparent his supervisors have no stomach to pick a fight with the Russians, but Gust thinks differently. He seeks out Wilson, the two assembles the funds and strategy and the teams that are covertly supplied to the Mujahideen to give them a chance to fight the big red war machine and drag the USSR into its own analogue of Vietnam. Along the way, they'll visit Pakistani presidents, Mossad arms dealers with Mossad accents, and truly terrifying Texan socialites composed seemingly entirely of mascara, played by Julia Roberts. It's presented as being directly responsible for the downfall of Soviet Russia, although in reality, of course, it's a little more complex than that.
One or two more factors.
Yeah. Like the man himself, it's a bit of an odd mix. That said, you don't find all that much out about the man himself. Yeah, you don't find much more about him other than he doesn't like communists.
But he does like the booty.
Yeah, well, it turns out that he's, for a southern congressman, he's actually quite liberal. He's pro-choice on abortion. He fought for the regulation of utilities, the introduction of Medicaid, tax exemptions for the elderly, and the minimum wage bill.
So he's almost sensible, then.
Well, he's practically a communist himself. Yeah, what's odd about the film, it's a slightly uneasy mix of comedy and borders on farcical at points, and austere political statements, and occasional yee-haw flag-waving about good old Uncle Sam. It's sort of alright, I suppose. Philip Seymour Hoffman steals the show, as usual. Tom Hanks is perfectly acceptable, and Julia Roberts isn't.
It seems to be drawing a lot of award nominations and plaudits. Are you daring to suggest that these may be wrong?
I can't see what's Oscar-worthy about it. I mean, again, Philip Seymour Hoffman is awesome, but it's a really odd thing. It is basically a light-hearted knockabout comedy, and it's not really the sort of subject you'd want to make a light-hearted knockabout comedy about.
I strongly suspect that given the output of American cinema over the past year, they're really actually struggling for films to put forward.
Yeah, about as close to it as I can get to. That and the fact, well, Tom Hanks, he just seems to automatically get put in the hat anyway.
Drew, would you concur with Scott's sentiments on Charlie Wilson's War?
Yes. I didn't know quite what to make of this film. I was left feeling deeply uneasy about certain moments of it. For instance, a juxtaposition of a funny, almost farcical moment followed swiftly by a toddler with no arms who'd been injured in a mine attack. And it just felt at points that it was making light of the suffering of the Afghan people under the Russians and the fact there was a war going on.
Yeah, it does feel like a script where someone's wrote a light-hearted comedy about, ooh, isn't it a wonderful war? And then someone sat there and went, well, we should try and have a message as well. And just dropped in about five scenes where it's like, okay, harrowing refugee camp, horrifically maimed children. And then occasionally someone's went, that's actually too down. Let's have some upbeat things. And they've got a montage of the numbers of helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft that Mujahideen have shot down. August, 25 helicopters shot down. Yay, go us.
Yeah, it's very sort of yee-haw, isn't it, as you mentioned earlier. The juxtaposition doesn't work, though. Sometimes if something's funny and then you have a deeply sad moment, it can be all the more affecting for it, but this film's simply not well enough written for that to work, and it feels very, very uncomfortable. And there are bits that are very funny, but it's, as a whole, it doesn't really gel.
It never feels like Charlie Wilson is some crusading All-American or anything like that. It's just like someone just filling time or anything else. It's like, well, so it seems like a good thing to do. Let's go and do it. He's not driven by any massive political ideals or anything.
Yeah, especially when he's not whoring and carousing. He's spending time in hot tubs with strippers or in his most awesome of all offices with the delectable Amy Adams too. He deigns to spend some time in committees, and he doesn't really seem to, in the film, have any political drive. And he's largely decided that, although get the idea that having visited the Afghan refugee camps in Peshawar and Pakistan, that he's been affected by the plight. Largely, he was driven to go there because the woman he was sleeping with said, this is a good idea. And Philip Seymour Hoffman is roundly awesome. He's always a great addition to any film. And you'd happily sit and watch him for another half hour, preferably to replace Julia Roberts, although not wearing the same sort of dresses, obviously. But I'm still feeling largely meh about the film. It's not awful. It's not a bad film, but certainly not a great film. It doesn't deserve the awards buzz it's been generating. Now, Tom Hanks is, as usual, at very least, pretty good self. There's nothing wrong with his performance. It just doesn't particularly grab you. It's adequate by Tom Hanks' standards, which is pretty good by most other people's. But there's nothing to say, yeah, this is a great film, go and watch it. And Philip Seymour Hoffman is going to be great in anything. So you'd expect that, but it's hanging together very well, the film. It doesn't quite know what it should be.
Yeah, it's a fairly mediocre experience. Very much a favourite word of the last couple of podcasts is mediocre.
Mediocre. We're sorry to be so average.
I almost wish there were more bad films, because you can say worse.
What, you haven't found enough bad films in the last year?
Howdy folks, Scott here. Having edited the fat out of this episode, it's come to my attention that this one's somewhat content light, shall we say. The tragic result of this for you, dear listener, is that in a transparent attempt to bulk this up, I have to witter on at you about a documentary which I saw recently, King of Kong. First off, a confession, I like video games. I've been playing them for about as long as I've been able to understand the concept of a video game, and as such, it's at least in some very small part my fault that a market exists for video game adaptations. So I'd like to apologise for Doom, the Tomb Raider films, Super Mario Brothers, all that Uwe Boll nonsense, and, well, let's just say all of them for shorthand. At any rate, I guess I'm the slender segment of the market that represents the target audience for a documentary about someone's attempt to break the high score record on Donkey Kong. Yes, you heard that correctly. It's about a man's attempt to set the high score record in the age-old Nintendo barrel jumping simulator. This probably tells you all you need to know about the film, but like I say, we've got time to burn here. In the blue corner is Billy Mitchell, at the outset the incumbent of the Twin Galaxies leaderboard, Twin Galaxies being the self-appointed official body of video gaming. He was the closest thing to a poster child for the pastime back in the day of the Subject Game's original release, despite the handicap of being an odious twerp. In the red corner is Steve Weib, an unassuming high school teacher and a far more likeable chap, with the usual provisos that we're only seeing what Johnny the Rector and Frank Editor want you to see. He's just finished a tape of what ought to be a new high school record, but on submission of the tape to Walter Day, the Twin Galaxies head honcho, he finds himself rapidly embroiled in a fight against a nerd machine who, with only a very slight justification, would rather keep their golden boy in the top spot. But is it interesting, I'll pretend to hear you ask, to which I must reply, it's a film about setting high scores in Donkey Kong. Of course it isn't interesting. Even as someone with what might, if you squint a little, be a vested interest in finding this film interesting, I don't find it interesting. So, no, this isn't an interesting film. It is, however, a well-crafted documentary, at least in as much as it's judged in this post-Moorean docu-era of imposing a narrative on events and casting people as heroes and villains. In particular, Billy Mitchell lives up to his villain billing well, coming across as a boastful egotist that's thoroughly unpleasant to be around. Is it an accurate interpretation of events? The only true answer to that question can be, who cares? The events documented are of so little import, although clearly so vital to those involved, that this often comes across as being a Chris Guest mockumentary. I guess the point of this diatribe, if we can charitably describe it as such, is to say that if a relatively high-intensity geek like me can't find much to like in this film, then I can only imagine the uncharted depths of tedium that real people will experience should they happen upon it. Consider yourself warned, citizens. There still seems to be a few moments left remaining to us, so allow us to present a short musical interlude.
Yeah, Podcast Land! Check this out, we got something special for you. My man Drew Tavendale, he gonna tell you all about Alvin and the Chipmunks, man. We got DJ Craig Disco on the beatbox, crazy-ass style, you know what I'm saying? We got MC Scott Morris.
Yeah,
live on vocal, spitting that shit, man, all for you. We gonna put this together, we gonna drop this shit one time, you know what I'm saying? All right, Glasgow, get ready for this shit. This shit is real, motherfucker.
Yeah, feel it.
Alvin and the Chipmunks. Drew Man, drop a knowledge bomb.
It's a film about chipmunks. Bloody awful film. It's a film about chipmunks. Bloody awful film. It's a film about chipmunks. Bloody awful film. For the benefit of our listeners who might be considering watching it, all I can say is don't. Bloody awful film.
Alvin!
Fresh.
Now, don't make us do that again. I now return you to our regular scheduled programming.
Another film which seems to have been drawing plaudits recently from all camps is The Kite Runner. Scott, what's that all about?
Essentially two stories. It kicks off in Afghanistan's brief period of relative peace after booting out the British and before the Soviets rolled in. Young Amir, played by Zakaria Ibrahim, is the son of relatively well-off, politically outspoken firebrand Baba, at which point I'm basically going to apologise and not pronounce any actors' names because I don't think I'm capable of it just now. Amir doesn't seem to have the reservoirs of self-confidence that his father has, and overhearing his dad's concerns about him clearly doesn't help. He's great friends with his servant's son, Hassan, who's rather more forward and more likely to take the local bullies. The pair win a kite-dueling contest, which wins some respect from Baba.
Hardcore.
But Amir doesn't feel worthy of it, especially after he's just walked away from witnessing a brutal sexual assault on Hassan from a local shower of odious cretins.
Schoolboy error.
Ashamed, rather than take steps to remedy the situation, he comes up with a scheme to remove Hassan from the picture and put him out of sight. Although not long after this, the Soviets roll in and Amir and Baba pick up sticks and go off to America. Strand 2 takes place over a decade later, with Amir having graduated college and put out his first novel. He's approached and told a few shocking truths, and as a result must head back into the Taliban-infested hell of Afghanistan in an attempt to rescue a child from an orphanage.
Is it like a sandy version of Doom?
Yes, less cackle demons, though.
Cool.
That was quite an impressive film. More good performances. It's a strong narrative, although it's kind of hampered by essentially being two more or less disparate films. Two, despite having the same characters, don't really share an awful lot in common apart from location and characters, which I suppose is quite a lot, never come to think about it. I'm not entirely convinced about the kind of Oscar buzz that it's been getting. It's a very good film, but I can't see what's so special about it that would sort of put it over the edge. But certainly it's one of the stronger films to go out in the last couple of months.
It seems to be a very sort of contentious sort of Oscar. Well, I know the Oscars haven't been announced at this point, but certainly the films which have been sort of allotted with awards nominations recently seem to be a sort of a middling bunch. There aren't any, well, a film we'll probably talk about next week aside, there aren't any sort of really particularly strong candidates, are there?
Yeah, I mean, as usual, I don't think any of them are bad films, but whether they're special enough to be warranted of anything great. But then again, if you look at last year, the only two films that I thought were particularly special happened to be German, so...
Yeah.
I suppose they're limited by what comes out in a year.
True. Drew, what was The Kite Runner all about for you?
Having seen the same version of the film as Scott did, it was about the same thing for me. But yeah, I enjoyed the film, and particularly enjoyed the performance of both the child and adult Amir. Managed to almost make you feel sympathetic for what's not a particularly pleasant character. Not through his action, but more through his inactions. But I suppose for that, he's a more believable character, a more likely real human being as opposed to a typical movie hero. I don't quite understand the Oscar buzz around it, but again, I think it's possibly the best of a poor field. I've just spent the whole year wondering what's a really great film. There have been a fair number of good films, of which this is certainly one, but not very many outstanding, which is perhaps why it's been getting the Oscar buzz it has, because there's not really a lot great deal else to choose from.
Possibly it's just Mark Foster, the director, having some kind of photographic evidence of some Oscar judges doing something bad, because of course he directed Monsters Ball, which I never quite saw the fuss about either. It's a strange career path. Stranger Than Fiction, The Kite Runner, the next Bond film.
Yeah.
How queer.
Very curious. And the film's certainly worth seeing. It's interesting. And the point you made about the two strands being disparate, I think it's almost deliberate too, because the two... It's almost like two different countries.
Well, absolutely.
The reason that the Afghanistan at the beginning is... Yeah, I wouldn't say it's not affluent. It's still a poor country, but people seem reasonably happy. There are bustling markets. I mean, people
had less mines in the street.
Yeah, people had a life. There were marketplaces. People were reasonably happy. They had some freedom of expression, freedom of religion. And the Afghanistan that Amir returns to collect a child later on in the film is just...
It's basically Mordor.
Yeah, there's nobody on the street. The Taliban are on beard patrol. I mean, it sounds like a joke, but in fact isn't.
Yeah.
Making sure that all men are fully bearded. And I think perhaps the two stories feel this way. It's possibly deliberate because the two, it's two different countries. And
yeah, well, again, that's fair enough. There's a lot of these things, though. It's supposed to be bad, but it's still bad. Yeah. It's, you're still not helping. You're still not drawing me into it by having two disparate threads. So.
Yeah, and they do feel disconnected. Again, possibly a little bit, so I'm not sure quite what the effect would be. I mean, it's a good film, though. It has you thinking a couple of points, and if you're anything like me, we'll probably be screaming at the TV at the whole idea of the Taliban. It's like, once again, religion messing up people's lives.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that would be a good enough reason on its own to commend it.
Mm-hmm. I think it is very well produced. It's very well done. My normal litmus test for this sort of thing is, did my dad like it? Because he's not normally into anything with subtitles, and my dad did like this. So if you're my dad, you'll like this film. Although if you're my dad, you already know. But if you're like my dad, which you probably won't be able to judge not knowing much about my dad, but if you are like him, you'll like this film too.
Fresh. One film which, fortunately, Drew and Scott did approve of this week is Dan in Real Life, starring Steve Carell. Scott, do you want to fill everybody in on the basic premise of that?
Widower Dan Burns, played by Steve Carell, is the writer of an Agony Uncle column who heads off to a traditional, sizeable family get-together at his parents' gaff with his three daughters of various stages of grown-up in tow. While Dan's parents, his sister and her husband keep the kids occupied, Dan's sent out for some alone time on the pretext of getting some papers. While he's out in town, he bumps into Marie, played by Juliette Binoche. The two get to talking, and for the first time since the death of his wife, he feels a very special connection with someone with bumpy bits in different places to his bumpy bits. There's a mutual attraction, although it's complicated by Marie being in a relationship with someone else. Anyway, he gets his number, so hooray for Dan. At least until he gets back home, where he finds that his younger brother, Mitch, played by Dane Cook, is introducing Marie as his new squeeze. Oh no! Sure, you probably get the idea of what's going to happen after that. It's not massively original in terms of its plot. In fact, it tends towards dinner theatre farce in places, but it's elevated to something special purely by dint of the performances. As an ensemble piece, it's pitch perfect. I can't recall seeing any group of actors feel so much like a cohesive family unit than for Lord knows how long. Carell delivers the goods again. There's no one doing this sort of low-key comedy as well just now, apart maybe from Bill Murray. But Carell just knocks out of the park, and he proves that he's a more than capable dramatic actor as well, not just comedic. Very good performances from Binoche and Cook. It's frequently hilarious, it's occasionally touching. The only slight niggle I could possibly find to pick with it was that it falls into a kind of traditional genre pitfall of having to give every character a happy ending. Whereas perhaps it might be a bit better off if one of them actually didn't. Might make it a little bit more affecting if everything wasn't just a zero-sum game. But yeah, that nitpick aside, I would be very, very surprised if I'm not putting this very near the top of my 2008 top 10 film list.
Was that good?
Absolutely. Certainly it would be at least number 3 in the top 10 films of 2007 had it come out a couple of weeks before.
Bloody hell.
There we go. It is very, very good. It's not doing anything particularly new, particularly original, it's just doing it extraordinarily well.
I'm quite surprised to hear that. That's come from out of the left field. I like it.
Well, if you've been looking at IMDb's user ratings, it's at about 7.5. So, people, you're wrong. All of you.
Well, let's think about it here. 7.5 rounds up nicely to pretty much 4 out of 5, doesn't it? If we're talking on the old starometer, the old one-liner.
Yes, but it should be 5 out of 5.
Mm-hmm. I would go that far.
You would go that far?
Hells yes.
Drew, it sounds to me like you concur.
It's an excellent film. It's one of the best films I've seen in quite some time. I couldn't actually find any fault to pick with it, and I didn't want to spend any time doing it. It's nice to see a film, and it's still a week later, nice sort of warm, contented glow, having seen a film which has done so well, and I could find nothing wrong with, and it's just truly enjoyable. If you've seen Little Miss Sunshine, it almost feels like a companion piece to that. It's the same sort of tone to it and same sort of gentle humour with some genuine laugh out loud moments and the same sort of great performance from Steve Carell as well, who just managed to do low-key humour, as you said, and pathos so, so well. And it's quite refreshing because the last thing I saw Steve Carell in was the awful Evan Almighty. The less said about it, the better. Yeah, it's just a great film. I'm struggling to put into words just anything more than Scott has said. It's just
admit it. Just say you love it. Love is not something to be afraid of.
I love it with all my heart.
There are moments of it that are like great farce, but they're played out in a way that almost would believe that it could happen because they
are these moments of farce better than Death at a Funeral?
Substantially, although not that much different in tone. There's a lot of people going into rooms as people are coming out of rooms and that sort of 1970s theatre kind of thing.
Yeah, the difference is the way it's written, and more importantly, the way it's played. It flies, you believe it. Mm. It's funny as opposed to being cringeworthy. Mm. When you're worried, you're embarrassed on behalf of the characters, you're just hoping that they get out of it okay. And everything just seems so... Okay, the farce bit aside, the emotions and the way that they're reacting towards each other just seems very, very believable. It's just played so well.
Yeah.
Everything is very, very natural.
It did feel like, when he comes into the room, he does feel like he's been treated as a warm family member when they've seen him for the first time in a while. I can't think of a film that's done it so well. I mean, it's the same sort of setup last year in, like, The Family Stone, as you were saying, which was dire and looked like people acting in a vacuum. And well, this doesn't differ massively. It's people going back to home for Christmas and having a little bit of a drama. This one just works so much better.
Yes. It's like The Family Stone, but good, and with considerably less Sarah Jessica Parker, which is always a good thing.
less horse.
I just can't find fault with it, and it's going to be... It's already the best film I've seen this year, though. Obviously, it sounds like it's damned with faint praise because this year's not got much to it yet, but at the end of the year, it's easily going to be... one of, if not the best film I've seen this year.
Good grief.
I can confidently say that.
Strong words, I'm going to have to check it out. Well, thanks for listening once again. Next time we speak to you guys, hopefully we will be talking to you about Ang Lee's Lust Caution, the Coen brothers' excellent No Country for Old Men, and a whole host of other stuff, which I promise I will have watched this time. Until then, thanks again for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, listeners, you have a special treat in store for you.